Top 100 Project.
And action.
Hey, podcast fans, and thanks for checking out the Top 100 Project, where we analyze the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the top 100 American movies. A hasty warning. We will be throwing out whatever spoilers we deem necessary. I'm Ryan Ellis with my fellow corrupt union member and wife, Bev.
Solidarity, Ryan.
Brothers forever. You notice how top billing for your name was fellow corrupt union member and not wife? We're so hilarious. Well, anyway, it's been a year. We posted our very first podcast one day shy of a year ago.
Yeah, happy anniversary, babe.
Happy podcast anniversary. We took 1 week off and have had four Top 100 Project movies to account for. 52 podcasts, because this is podcast number 47, which is on the waterfront. So, the coming attraction is trivia for the film. Which of Marlon Brando's three co-stars appeared in the most AFI movies? Rod Steiger, Lee J. Cobb, or Carl Malden?
I'm going to guess Carl Malden?
You are guessing, aren't you?
Totally.
You don't know their movies, do you?
No, I know one of Carl Malden's movies, which is the only reason why I'm guessing him.
And that would be?
Streetcar Named Desire.
That is correct. Yeah, Malden and Steiger did two more each, so they did three in total, and Cobb was in two in total. Obviously, all three of them had this film in common, so Steiger's other two were Dr. Zhivago and In the Heat of the Night, both in the 60s, and then Malden's were Streetcar Named Desire, this, and then Patton.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he's in that, along with George C. Scott, and Lee J. Cobb's only other film was 12 Angry Men, which we're going to cover before we get to any of those other titles. And incidentally, I didn't include Eva Marie Saint in this list, and she's only got one other AFI film, which we will get to not too long after 12 Angry Men. And that would be, you know it.
I actually don't know it.
North by Northwest.
Oh, you did know it. I did know it. I forgot that was on the list.
Well, we just made our credits list for all these actors a lot easier than we normally do. They've covered it already. All right, so the Top 100 Project's 47th movie, On the Waterfront, was 8th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list between The Graduate and Schindler's List, but fell all the way to 19th in 2007 between The General and It's a Wonderful Life. On the Waterfront premiered in New York on July 28th, 1954, then Columbia released it on August 6th, and following up on fellow Columbia release From Here to Eternity's awards and financial success the previous summer, On the Waterfront made a killing, and it made a lot of friends in the critical community. Bev will tell us about the film with her skinny.
Boxer turned longshoreman Terry Malloy, played by Marlon Brando, goes through a crisis of conscience after many years of witnessing, sometimes aiding, local union thuggery on the New Jersey docks. Rod Steiger is Charlie, Terry's brother, and the right-hand man of Johnny Friendly, played by Lee Cobb, the corrupt union boss. Terry's Jiminy Crickets are Eva Marie Saint as Edie and Carl Malden as Father Barry.
Or in a nutshell, bloodied manual laborer shows up for a union job.
Yeah, I hope their union has a good health care plan or sick day policy or something, because he's beaten nearly to death.
They have Brando care. Yes, he has almost killed him. This is not the first, I wouldn't say, but one of the many in Brando's long string of movies where he's beaten to a pulp.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson has that same thing in his movies where he's often beaten up beyond recognition.
Well, he does have a little sadomasochism streak in him.
Yeah, Brando's biggest assault maybe in any movie, well, I suppose this one's pretty huge, but in a movie called The Chase he did, where he's just beaten up.
Well, he gets shot nearly to death in The Godfather as well.
True, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, anyway, On the Waterfront, what'd you think?
So, I'm missing something. I liked this movie, but it's 8th on the 98 list, and then it's, 19th in 2007? Yeah, it dropped, but it's still way high up there. I liked this movie, but I don't get it. Even if you wanted to credit the acting,
that's what it's all about.
But then I would say Streetcar Named Desire, better.
Yeah, Streetcar's better lower ranked both times.
Yeah, you and I, and I didn't make my feelings a secret, that I'm just not, I don't know, I'm just not crazy about this movie, and I don't know why. I can't really put my finger on what it is about it that kind of failed to capture me. Maybe it's because it's just so clear-cut, squeaky clean hero and mustache twisting villain. I guess he's not squeaky clean, is he?
Malloy, definitely not.
No.
He's got one of the better arcs we've seen in most characters so far.
His character's good and his performance is great and the writing is there and there's scenes that really, really work for me. But as a whole, I don't know, I just didn't care. But
you
this
also
is the movie
said,
that...
hang on, I gotta say this part. You also said the infamous thing during the movie when we took a break. She's a little bored.
Oh, so bored. There was parts that were a little boring. When it was the whole middle part of them just basically trying to convince Terry Malloy to turn against the union leader and stand up to the union, it just goes on and on and on. And of course, you know he's going to eventually stand up to the union. You know he's going to get there. So watching Eve Marie Saint and Carl Malden just beat him over the head with it for the entire movie, and one thing after another happened until finally he's convinced, I found it a little boring.
Well, they have to lay that pipe.
Okay.
He's a bit of a dumbass.
He is. He's yeah, so and he plays that well.
He's not going to catch on quickly. I mean, for a guy who is so bright, he often played pretty dumb characters quite well. Well, you know, he's not exactly brilliant in Streetcar either.
You kind of have to be smart to play someone stupid believably. And he really pulls it off.
And gullible, because when he even says in the opening scene, when he sets up Joey Doyle, Eve's brother, to go to the roof and get thrown off and killed, I just thought they were going to lean on him a little bit.
Yeah.
No, come on, you know that.
He's naive.
These people better than that.
Yeah, his brother's not stupid. His brother's not naive.
Yeah, his whole boxing career, which ended whenever it was not last week or last month. Mm-hmm. It's been a while. He's been working for these people in these manual labor jobs and obviously doing, as we said at the top, thug-type stuff. One thing I was thinking about when you talk about comparisons, Rocky. You still have not seen Rocky.
No.
Beginning of the film, he's a loser club fighter, so he is still active, unlike Terry. But he's also working for a local bad guy. He's a leg breaker, as Richard Meredith calls him later. And that's what Terry... Well, Terry's not the goon.
No.
But he's involved in it.
It kind of seems like he's just more like the guy that hangs around because his brother...
Gets the scraps.
...is his right-hand man. So, yeah, he gets the scraps. Like, every once in a while, they ask him to help out with something, and then he gets the good jobs. And but it's not like he works for Johnny Friendly. You don't get the impression he's really part of that group. He's just kind of a nearby person.
Right.
So I did not make much of a secret of the fact that I didn't enjoy this film, and when it was all said and done, and I told you that, I don't think I've ever seen you get more upset that I didn't enjoy a film than I saw your reaction.
I was upset?
Well, you usually, you know...
Disappointed that you didn't like it?
Yeah, your disappointment was more than I usually see you
I think
express.
It'll play off of something I was thinking about when you were talking a minute ago, that we were both surprised how much you've liked our three Westerns so far.
Yeah.
Stagecoach.
Shane.
High Noon. And that's not a genre I expected you like that much.
Yeah.
And you haven't liked some of the... Well, I guess this is a melodrama. You haven't liked some of the dramas. And
yeah,
I would have thought they'd be more up your alley. Especially ones that are pretty simple plot, good screenplay, great performances.
It's just not my genre, man. I'm not into melodrama.
Well, I don't know if this is really melodrama, though. I think
this is not a melodrama. Well, it certainly has melodrama elements, but I don't know if I would call it melodrama. Although, I guess it does fit into some of those...
Yeah,
those
fits into
boxes,
some...
right?
I think you just call it a plain drama, though. And that's what I'm saying. It surprised me that you wouldn't have dug this for the simple reasons of what it is. It's one of the more simple movies in the top 10.
But you could probably, you know, we
20.
Say drama, we say Western. You could probably easily compare a lot of what happens in this movie, plot point and kind of conflict points. A lot of those things would match up well with something like High Noon. There were scenes, and I'm not kidding when I say there were scenes that were just beautiful and really captivating. I love the scene when him and Eve Marie Saint are walking and he puts her glove on his hand. That little bit of business is so... There's something just beautiful about it.
That's a story that's talked about in the AFI special. Dustin Hoffman brings it up about how Brando did that and everyone on the crew is, oh, I guess the scene's over. And Kazan was saying... I don't know if we mentioned yet. Elie Kazan is the director of the film.
Mm-hmm. Very important to talk about him.
Yeah, we're going to get to him. Huge part of this podcast would be about the subtext involving him. But he's the one behind the camera saying, no, keep it going, let the scene play out. The point is that it was not supposed to be in the script, that he puts the glove on her hand.
That was an improv.
She wasn't supposed to drop it. And they played that up. What I like about that scene so much is that he's gently picking off the little pieces of dirt as he has it on his hand.
It's so gentle.
Yeah, just like he did something in Streetcar. When he has a moment early on, he's trying to convince Stella that maybe your sister's not telling you the truth. He picks this piece of lint off of the back of her very gently. Roger Ebert talked about it in his review.
It's an intimate gesture.
Right. And it's such a gentle thing to do. So it plays back into that in a way, too. That's what the detail I like about the glove scene so much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing about this movie that I suppose stands out the most would be those kinds of famous moments. Before we get into the politics with Kazan, before we get into some of the other people, let's talk about the most famous scene in this movie.
Yes.
And one of the most famous scenes in the history of film, and certainly one of the most famous pieces
of
dialogue. Yeah,
we've had a lot
of
these lately. A lot of these incredibly famous scenes, these images that immediately conjure not just these movies specifically, but film history in general and classic films, like Singing in the Rain when he's dancing.
From Here to Eternity.
From Here to Eternity,
the
them making out in the surf. Marlon Brando with Rod Steiger in the back of the car. Could have been a contender.
And the reason why that scene plays out so well is Brando didn't believe the scene. My brother pulls a gun on me? How do I play that?
He just didn't know how to react because he wouldn't believe that this character would do that to his own brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, Kazan told him to play it.
There's a nice callback, though, really early on in the film, when they're all in the union shop down on the waterfront, and Terry's standing beside the table where Charlie's doing the books or doing paperwork, whatever it is he's doing. And because he'd set up Joey the night before, or a few nights before, whenever it was, and he's getting all kinds of kudos from mm-hmm. Johnny. Mm-hmm. And Charlie reaches up and he touches Terry really gently on the arm, this kind of this brotherly, like, he did a good thing, he's a good kid. He doesn't say anything. I cannot forget that moment for the rest of the movie, that Charlie was tender with him in this nice little moment.
Yeah.
And obviously if Terry could have just been their setup guy and their fall guy.
Or even if he could have just stayed out of it and...
Mm-hmm. Not grown a conscience.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it would have been fine. Now, of course, Charlie's using him. There's no doubt about that. But yeah. Charlie doesn't want bad things for him. And that whole thing about, oh, Charlie, and he gently pulls the gun away. My favorite moment in the whole scene, okay, it's easy to say that it's that could have been a contender. Part of it is great. And Brando's whole performance is great. But I love the part when they cut wide, and Steiger's got the gun in his ribs, trying to get him to take this job, and just gently pushes it away. And then Steiger kind of falls back defeated.
Yeah.
Because in that second, he knows one of us is going to die. It's supposed to be you, as much as I'm torn up about yeah. the fact it has to be you. Either I got to kill you or someone else is going to do it when we get where we're going. Or if I don't, they're going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't do it. I can't kill my brother. A lot of movies or TV shows would have played that up more on Charlie. But smartly, it's just as simple as that. Slump back in the seat. I'm going
to
die.
And the performance tells the story without needing to put it into words.
Mm-hmm.
Needing to express it that much. See, I've seen this scene, or really those particular lines of the scene that are so famous. I've seen it so many times, I couldn't begin to count. But this is the first time I've ever seen it in context, and it could have been ruined for me by all the repetitions and seeing it over and over again, but it wasn't. Now that I had context and watching that scene again, it was heartbreaking. Him talking about how his brother sold him out and made him throw the fight and going through that betrayal, you know, many years later, it's really meaningful. It's like, I understand why that is such a famous scene.
So first piece of trivia,
mm-hmm.
what is the last name of the fighter that Terry could have taken apart that night?
Oh my God, I have no idea.
Wilson. Many years later, 50 years later, Pulp Fiction, Butch's opponent is Wilson.
No kidding.
Yep, it says when you see them drive by in the cab, the marquee, it says Coolidge, Butch's last name, versus Wilson.
Ah.
And he was supposed to throw his fight,
yep.
but of course he does not do it. So that's, I'm sure, deliberate on the part of Tarantino to call back to this movie 50 years before.
Mm, oh, yeah.
One of the many influences that On the Waterfront, and that scene in particular, played into. Yeah, and then that's the whole point of it, too. Terry had been, according to him at least, a good fighter. He could have gone somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And by throwing the fight, he lost his chance to do something meaningful. You might want to say, well, it doesn't have to be over like that. Well, in the sense of boxing, yeah, because the mob is so behind it. Raging Bull is another one. Scorsese is a gigantic fan of this movie. He's talked about it many times. I think it's actually influenced more than just Raging Bull. The obvious influence is on Raging Bull because you've got some of the same themes. The brother problems between De Niro and Pesci in that movie were mirrored in this one. You got the mob. Nicholas Colasanto, who played Coach on Cheers, is Johnny Friendly in a sense. And there's a lot of, and Black and White, and the boxing part of it, and all those things. But I think it's influenced other movies that Scorsese's made too. Sometimes he'll have those brother characters, so those characters aren't literally brothers, who let each other down and then get each other killed, maybe. And there's that constant threat of violence in his movies because of things like this, because there's that one guy, Johnny Friendly, hey, if he's gone at the end of this movie, I'll be back. Oh, I just gave away one of my other trivia questions. What was the last line of dialogue in this movie?
Is it, I'll be back?
Indeed it is. Lee J. Cobb, I wanted to use my Schwarzenegger voice and giving that one away, but anyway, there you go. It's implied that he's out as the union boss. No one's going to have any faith in him anymore, but maybe he will be. And even if he's not going to stick on as the union boss, somebody's mm-hmm. going to fill that gap.
I wonder if this is part of the problem that I have with the movie. Part of the reason why I couldn't really enjoy it is because it really feels like in the end, they didn't accomplish much. You know, he has this big moment and he takes this big stand, but at the end of the day, the union is still there and Johnny Friendly is still the boss, and even if he steps down, somebody's going to take his place. There's still all this corruption. Clearly, it's not as if there was no union that the docks would suddenly start treating their employees well and everything would be harmonious. I hardly think that's likely. It doesn't seem like there's really any resolution that's going to improve the lives of these workers. It's just kind of satisfying to watch him stand up to them.
I don't think that's true. Mm. I think it's small victories that lead to bigger victories, especially when it comes to union battles. It isn't always about that one big moment. And this movie has a pretty big moment, actually. We've talked about how writers, directors, and actors at this point in history have been blackballed and blacklisted, I should say, from movies. Now we have a character who's been blacklisted.
Mm-hmm.
Because John even says to him in the hearing when Terry testifies against him, and he says, you'll never work anywhere and wherever it is. Mm-hmm. Basically, the entire eastern seaboard, you'll never work again on the docks, which is all that Terry's really good for at this point. What else is he going to do? He's a palooka. He's a bum. Anyway,
he says that so many times in the movie. He uses that word exactly 4 or 5 times, calls himself a bum or gets called a bum.
Right. And so here's a character who's blacklisted, but then he stands up and the union's with him. And I think that's the point, is that they don't listen to Johnny. They follow Terry. And when they follow Terry, then maybe things could change. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, too, about Johnny stepping down. Well, Johnny's going to maybe go to jail because those hearings are all about the fact mm-hmm. that they're leading to that point in the first place. There's a useless trivia question. In those hearings, what do we find out is Johnny Friendly's real name?
Oh, I can't remember.
Michael Skelly.
And then, so where's Johnny come from? That's strange.
Maybe he's, well, Friendly is pretty obvious.
Friendly, okay, but Johnny from, like, anyway.
Because it's so folksy, I guess. Could be Mikey Friendly.
He was based on a real dude. Like, it was based on a real situation. I think everybody,
every major character is based on.
Yeah, the screenwriter, Bud Schilberg, spent a month meeting with Anthony DiVincenzo, who was a whistleblower, a dock worker, and he testified himself before a real-life waterfront commission. And suffered ostracization for it. And ironically, DiVincenzo had to sue Columbia Pictures to have his part in the film recognized and compensated for. It's just a bunch of bullies all around. Everywhere you go, there are bullies taking over and taking advantage of people. The film
business has bullies?
What?
Hard to believe. All right, we'll probably come back to the cab scene throughout the rest of this podcast because it is so famous. Except a couple other tidbits I guess I could throw right away. That Sam Spiegel, the producer, did not pay for the rear projection they should have had when they're driving around, so that's why there's blinds in the back window.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and if you notice that when they show the scene, I believe it's dissolved from the previous scene to that one, and the way Brando's getting the cab, it's like he's coming straight in. You point out he gets out of the cab on the wrong side.
Yes, that's right.
When Charlie lets him out. But the cab apparently has limousine-style legroom because of the way he gets in the first place.
Yeah, that's true.
That's Spiegel being a cheapskate. And the other thing about the scene, it's pretty well known if you follow this movie, is that Steiger was pretty angry with Brando for bailing for some, apparently, psychiatrist appointments. So when Steiger had his close-ups, he was doing it to a PA.
You know, considering what a committed actor Brando is, I would be angry, too, if somebody behaved that unprofessionally. I don't understand why actors don't always play against the other actors for their performance.
There's a nice story in the Green Mile documentary where Michael Clark Duncan is talking about how Tom Hanks was there for him. But apparently Hanks was giving Duncan 100%. And even the best actors don't always do that because they don't really need to.
If you're trying to make the best movie, that's how you're going to make the best movie, is by being that committed.
Well, Brando was a pretty selfish jerk a lot of the
time. Yeah, he was kind of, there's more stories to come.
And he was in the middle of this project. He was in the middle of this run of great work, too, so he would have been pretty high on himself.
So he's starting to get the prima donna.
Maybe so. He had done Streetcar.
It's going to get a lot worse
than that. He did Viva Zapata. He did Julius Caesar. He did this. Also, The Wild One. All in the span of this 4 or 5 years, he started with a movie called The Men. And it was not too long after this when his star started to fall, and I think it's because he got way too big for his britches, and he wasn't worth the trouble anymore. But that is one incredible run of great movies.
Yeah, but he wasn't supposed to be cast in this movie. It was supposed to be Frank Sinatra.
And he had the part at one point, but apparently.
And then Spiegel replaced him with Brando, mostly because he was such a big star that they knew they could double the budget with him signed
on. Sinatra had just come off of From Here to Eternity, which we talked about last week, being such a boon for Sinatra's career, but he got nothing to play the part, so he wouldn't have had that name brand the very next year.
Yeah,
it's the same studio, but it was about a year later when this one came out. And there's other characters, too. Apparently, Paul Newman was in talks to play the role. And as we've said many times lately, there's always going to be a ton of names mentioned for these movies. But obviously, Brando was the right choice for it. So the other person that had to try to leverage Brando into the role and manipulate him to a certain extent was the director, Elia Kazan. Let's talk about Elia Kazan's history. Because between Streetcar Named Desire and this movie is when he did testify against his supposed communist friends.
He named names.
Named names. One of the biggest names that ever did that. Maybe the biggest Hollywood name that ever did that.
Yeah, well, he certainly got the worst reputation for it. I'm sure he wasn't the only person to do it. But he's kind of the poster boy for people who sided with the House of Un-American Activities and McCarthy. And got people blacklisted, ruined people's careers, because once upon a time they were associated with the Communist Party, which he was also, and then had a change of heart. And I understand that people would have considered communism a real threat at the time, and that may have been part of his motivations. But he also kind of has some quotes and talked about it in a way that doesn't really do himself any favors.
What did he say?
Well, I found this quote about when On the Waterfront won all of its Oscars. It did very well at the Oscars. And his quote was, "I was tasting vengeance that night and enjoying it. On the Waterfront is my own story. Every day I worked on that film, I was telling the world where I stood and my critics to go and F themselves." So he was on a high horse.
Yeah.
And he wasn't really handling it with all that much grace. You love what happened. You love the story about what happened when he got his honorary Oscar in the
90s. Talked about it on Streetcar. Would have been for the 98 awards in 1999 because Nick Nolte was there for Affliction and Harris was there for The Truman Show. And they showed the two of them in the crowd with horribly angry looks on their faces. Amy Madigan and Harris's wife may look even madder than the two of them combined. None of them standing, none of them applauding, and you have a lot of other people, Warren Beatty, who worked with them, enthusiastic standing ovation.
Yeah, there was a very mixed reaction from the crowd.
Which is so rare when you get an honorary award, any kind of award when you're an older person, the Gene Herschel humanitarian, you're likely to get standing ovation because you're a humanitarian.
And decades later, too.
Yeah, because they ended up working for a long time. But yeah, when you get one of those career achievement kind of awards, if you don't get a standing ovation, you definitely don't get people not applauding you visibly, especially big names, but that's what happened. Yeah, he made an awful lot of enemies, including Arthur Miller, his friend, who had written an early draft of this script. You mentioned Bud Schoenberg, but Miller was supposed to have been the writer, and then they had the falling out because of what he did. Miller was one of the people who was on the outside looking in, and then he wrote The Crucible, which was made into a movie in 1996 or 7, which I saw not that long ago, actually.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it's on Netflix. I took a look at it. Daniel Day-Lewis, one of the few movies he did in the 90s. Joan Allen plays his wife, and I believe is Winona Ryder, and is based on Miller's play.
So, I mean, he wrote a play, he didn't make a movie, but you always say, like, respond to criticism for a movie with another movie.
And I didn't make it clear that it's about a witch hunt. It's about the literal witch hunt. But, of course, that plays up what happened in the 50s with the communists.
And that is, like, a much more clear message with clear villains that seem to match the villains that were taking part in this in real life. And I struggle to see what Kazan was trying to do with this, because if he's trying to say that the Communist Party was like the union members, like Johnny Friendly, that just doesn't really seem to play out properly, you know? It actually seems the opposite, that the union was behaving the way the House of Un-American Activities behaved, because if you aren't with us, you're against us, and we're going to blackball you, and we're going to stop you from working. Well, that's exactly what HUAC was doing to all the professionals in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So it's strange to me that that's the film that he would make, except for that really great speech at the end where Terry tells everybody, I'm glad I ratted on you, I'm glad that I told on you and that I put an end to this, or helped put an end to this. That makes sense. But does he really believe that the Communist Party had the power and the influence and were bullies the way that the union was in on the waterfront? It just doesn't really work.
Okay, but we talked a minute ago about how Arthur Miller originally wrote the screenplay, which means obviously it was written before 1953 and 1954 when this movie was made. They would have made it sometime in 53. It comes out in 54. By the way, obviously in the winter time, because they look like they're so cold.
Yeah, you can see their breath.
Kazan talked about how the production of this movie was not that difficult. It was a pretty smooth production. The hardest thing was getting the actors to show up because it was so damn cold. Oh. And they're wearing ratty coats deliberately. That's kind of the point. And it's in Hoboken, New Jersey.
It probably helped to sell the authenticity of how miserable those workers were.
Yeah.
With their shoulders up to their ears. Sure. Yeah.
And their coats don't look like they're really warm enough. Some of them don't seem to have gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And they're waiting around outside. Sometimes they don't get to work at all. So then what are they going to do? It was set in Hoboken and it was filmed there too.
Yeah.
But Miller would have been writing the screenplay a few years before. And then somewhere in there, the HUAC stuff happens with Kazan. So suddenly maybe it becomes, okay, the story still exists about how this guy finally finds a conscience, does the right thing regarding his supposed friends and his brother and everybody else, and then gets everyone else to be on his side. But then the subtext for Kazan, that's when it comes into play.
Yeah.
Because this is based on some Pulitzer Prize winning articles written in the New York Sun by Malcolm Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And then Miller, obviously, and Schulberg and Kazan would have adapted from that. So we don't know what was changed. Maybe there was a lot less of the witch hunt type mentality in the earlier versions of the screenplay, and then Kazan, along with Schulberg, might have just tossed that in there.
Yeah.
Just speculating. Because that might address what you're talking about.
Yeah, that may be right. Maybe it was a mistake that I knew that story going into watching this film, because it did play on my mind and kind of colored the way I was interpreting it.
One of my coming attractions trivia questions that I've written way in advance is for Psycho. I might change it. I'm giving it away already because it's not really any trivia. It's just about an opinion piece. And that is, what are the most famous spoiler that you knew before you actually saw the movie? Including things like Psycho, Empire Strikes Back, Citizen Kane. If you know those movies, you know what the spoilers are before you ever saw the movie. And this one isn't so much about spoilers, but the same thing. You knew about the cab scene before you ever saw the movie. You would have heard about the Kazan stuff before you saw the movie.
Because
if you know about anything about Elie Kazan, you knew that. So maybe you knew too much.
Yeah, I definitely didn't see it with fresh eyes, and I'm a person that loves to see movies knowing as little about them as possible.
And so, the Westerns, for example, you didn't know anything about
those. It's true. I knew next to nothing. I knew a little more about Shane. I didn't really know that much about High Noon at all. I knew nothing about Stagecoach.
Right. Well, no matter how you are, I feel about the movie. One thing I didn't mention already, Rotten Tomatoes critics. 100% of the critics liked it, and 95% of the audiences.
What am I missing?
Gave it a big thumb up.
Seriously, this is not the first time this has happened with one of these films where I just feel like, how am I out of the loop on this? Why don't you tell me what you like about it? You really like this movie, right?
I think the story is good. I think the story is pretty simple. There's nothing wrong with that. I think the performances are fantastic. Obviously, Brando is the most famous one in this cast. Now that we've seen Streetcar on the Waterfront close together, his performance is more important and maybe, I don't know about better, but maybe more rewardable for what that's worth.
He's the lead in this film, too, where he's not in Streetcar Named Desire. Something else that I'd like to remark about his performance is he's a total chameleon. He almost looks like a different person in this versus Streetcar Named Desire. He seems to have different posture.
Yeah, he seems like such a brute. Well, he is such a brute in Streetcar. And he seems so physically big. Now he's opposite to
he's kind of like the small women. He's scary in a way. He's like somebody you just wouldn't in want Streetcar. To be trapped with.
Yeah, but
right?
in this movie, as a former boxer. Yeah. And apparently a good former boxer. And he never looks big and strong in this movie. No, he never comes across as somebody who actually is going to hurt anybody.
No, he's always comes across as 100% gentle.
And he has this fight with Johnny at the end before Johnny's goons get in there. And by the way, Johnny's goons were played by former boxers.
There's that one guy who had hands that they were the size of boxing gloves. They were enormous. He looked like a giant. He could look like Andre the Giant. He had that kind of look about him.
And Terry looks like middleweight, so he would be outmatched by these guys. But yeah, when he and Johnny are fighting without the goons getting involved before that happens, it's one of those kind of knockdown, drag out. It's not one of those John Wayne, Clint Eastwood Western type fisticuffs where they stand apart from each other and each take a shot and then the other guy takes a shot and then have a little bit of blood in their faces. And these guys are battered and bruised. And for 1954, Brando's got a lot of blood in his face when he gets up at the end.
Yeah, that fight is brutal. Yeah.
If it was a modern movie and the same thing happened, he'd be just bathed in it, I think. Mm-hmm. So for the time, it's extremely violent.
Yeah, it feels very realistic. There's nothing theatrical about it. It felt viscerally real.
One of the things as well about Johnny, now that I'm remembering that scene again, is that he's a terrorist. Because he's using fear to get what he wants. Mm-hmm. He's keeping all these union guys in line, including Terry, by using fear. And the fear of not working.
Yeah.
It is, and okay, it's about getting killed too, because that's what happens with Joey in the beginning of the film. But it's about keeping people afraid and getting what you want. By the way, I just mentioned Joey. We haven't talked about Dugan and then Terry. And they're the three guys that wear that same jacket, because Edie gives Joey's jacket to Dugan because he clearly needs it. Then he ends up dead. Trivia question number, whatever we're on here. What is in the crates that kills Dugan when he's on the ship?
Whiskey.
Yep. Ironic, he's killed by the drink, literally.
Yeah.
And that jacket goes from those three people. Two of them end up dead deliberately by Johnny's people. And then they almost kill Terry and they almost at least ruin him. But of course, this is finally the guy who succeeds. All right, so let's talk about the cast list here. Marlon Brando, second of four AFI films. He's still going to be in The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. Not exactly small titles for this guy. A lot of people are in four or five AFIers, and some of them are like, he's a small part of it, or it's a movie but no one cares about. No, these are pretty legendary movies.
Yeah.
And there's two other things I want to say about Brando before we get on to the other people on the cast. One is that if you look at one of the covers of the DVD, he looks like Jackie Gleason.
If you say so.
I've always thought that. Chance to say it publicly to our dozens of listeners. Finally, I can say it.
I'm going to speak my truth here.
Well, there's a lot of covers of every DVD and every poster, but if you know what I'm talking about, you see the same thing. Maybe people are listening to this and think, he's right, I thought the same thing.
Finally, somebody said it out loud.
And we talked about other actors who could have played the part. We didn't mention that John Garfield, it was apparently intended for him.
Originally. Oh, really?
He died before it came about. Yeah, he didn't last that long in the business, John Garfield.
I don't even know who he is.
No AFI films. He was in a few good movies. He was in The Postman Always Rings Twice in the 40s. It might be his most famous picture. An actor that a lot of people like. A friend of mine likes him a lot. I'm going to skim over the other cast members because we already talked about their credits at the top of the podcast. Lee J. Cobb, 12 Ring Man. He also was in The Exorcist. Not an AFI film, but could have been. Malden, Streetcar, Patton, did Streets of San Francisco TV show. Steiger, did Dr. Zhivago in The Heat of the Night. Eva Marie Saint was also in North by Northwest. Exodus, which is not an AFI film. And Superman Returns. She's still working even now.
Oh, wow.
She's still going.
I would be remiss if I didn't point out how excellent she is. She really adds a lot to the film. Her performance stands out. It could have been such a boring part. There really isn't that much to her. She's just kind of a girl looking to
She is what her last name is.
Yeah,
she's a saint.
Yeah. She kind of is playing a dull character, ultimately, but she brings some depth to it. And she's so strikingly beautiful. Like, it's almost distracting how pretty she is.
There's some grit to her, though, too, because she was raised in a hard place, and she was raised by one of the dock workers who wants to get her out of there.
And she sells it.
Yeah, she's very fine in the film. We didn't talk that much about her in the podcast. She was in one of her first films in this, and Grace Kelly could have played the role, but she turned it down to do a film we're going to do in 2 weeks, Rear Window.
Ooh.
Maybe a good choice on her part. She would have been good in this, I think, but she got to work with Hitchcock for the first time. So I guess both people won there. And Grace Kelly won the Oscar in 1954, for The Country Girl, another movie she did that year.
Oh, wow.
So she really won out because she still won some awards and got to be in big movies with big-name directors. And two more tiny uncredited roles I got to mention. Martin Balsam and Michael B. Gazzo. Martin Balsam is going to be in Psycho and, again, 12 Angry Men. And I think he's also in All the President's Men. I think he's one of the guys in the confession scene that Terry has when they're all in the courtroom.
Does he have a line?
I don't recall. I only read about it. I didn't even notice that he's in the scene, but I read that he is in the movie when I looked at the cast list. And the Michael Vigazzo is in Godfather Part 2 as Frankie Pandangeli.
There you go.
We're going to see them both, one of them pretty soon, the other one not till the mid-70s. We talked about Kazan. This is the last time we're going to talk about him officially because he's only had these two AFIs, this and Streetcar.
Only two. He only had made two movies that were considered in the top 100 American films.
Well, when you consider that other directors had three or four or five.
Oh, no, I know.
Although, looking at his filmography, there's nothing else I would have put in there. East of Eden probably had the best chance of all his other films. And that starred James Dean, who we're going to start seeing soon, a couple of weeks from now.
Still a pretty accomplished director. Two movies that people really love a lot.
He had directed Gentleman's Agreement in 1947 with Gregory Peck. Won some awards. Won him his first Best Director award, and he won one on this film. So, yeah, he had a hell of a career, for sure. But we're done with him, officially, AFI-wise. Bud Schulberg, we talked about already, his only AFI film, his only Oscar nomination. He went on to write A Face in the Crowd, probably the most famous other credit he had, which was with Andy Griffith in a very uncharacteristic jerk role.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, he was always known, of course, as Mr. Nice Guy, but not in that movie. And then Sam Spiegel, who we already talked about in African Queen, produced that, produced this, Bridge on the River Kwai, and Lawrence of Arabia. So he really did cover the basis of some major films. We're going to see them all in a fairly short period of time here. Behind the scenes, Boris Kaufman, the cinematographer, he also did, yet again, 12 Angry Men, and then Splendor in the Grass for Kazan later on, and The Pawnbroker in the mid-60s with Rod Steiger. Look at all these connections here. Gene Milford was the editor. He did Lost Horizon and Wait Until Dark. I mentioned those two because it's quite a dichotomy. You got an adventure film and then a horror film. Leonard Bernstein did West Side Story and On the Town, and the noteworthy thing with him is that he only ever did this one non-musical movie as far as writing music for it.
And I did not like the music that much. Or maybe I would have liked the music, but it's a little too...
Too much of it.
Yeah, just there when it didn't need to
be. We should have recorded the first time we said that and just drop that into all these podcasts and save our breath. But we almost always agree on that.
Yeah.
Too much music. And then Richard Day, a guy won 7 Oscars, including for this film. He was the set guy. He also designed sets for Streetcar, Grapes of Wrath, and a movie I like called The Oxbow Incident.
Doesn't seem like he really had that much work to do on this film.
No, it's funny. When I was reading about
shot it on location.
Yeah, no, they obviously shot it on location. I don't know how much was a set.
There's the apartment buildings and there's the dock, but it just didn't seem like there's that much to them.
Yeah, maybe they built that set, that tiny little set that represents the housing where Johnny Friendly's people are, the local, whatever the number was.
I guess it wasn't really something that you would have seen in Hollywood films a lot. There wouldn't have been a lot of representation of that working poor in a place like that. So maybe that was it. It would have been somewhat novel at the time to see something that authentic.
Yeah. Well, let's keep on talking about the award winners then, because I just mentioned a bunch of them. And just like our previous podcast, From Here to Eternity, this won 8 Academy Awards. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress, the screenplay by Schulberg, the editing by Milford, the cinematography by Kaufman, and Richard Day's sets. Most of those, in fact, or at least a lot of those, were shared with From Here to Eternity, actually. They both won Picture, Director, Supporting Actress, the screenplay, I think the editing, the cinematography.
Yeah, Columbia was on a streak.
Mm-hmm. And they had 4 other nominations, and they were the 3 supporting actors we talked about at the top of the podcast, and for Bernstein's music. The movie made the National Film Registry in 1989, not really a surprise, despite your dislike of it. A lot of people loved it so much. It had to be in that first group of protected films. We watched the DVD that I've had for a long time. I don't think it looked great, I didn't think it looked bad. I thought it was somewhere in the middle. Better than some of the other DVDs I've had forever that we've watched.
It's not the type of movie that necessarily going to gain that much from watching a perfect, crisp Blu-ray the way something like, say, Wizard of Oz would, but it looked pretty good.
I believe it's on Blu-ray and a Criterion Blu-ray, in fact. Oh, so it's probably sharp beyond belief, but we didn't see that version. As far as other AFI lists for the movie, it was 36 on the top 100. Cheers. Terry Molloy was the 23rd best good guy in the Heroes and Villains list. Bernstein's music was 22nd on the list of top 25 music scores. And, not surprisingly, 3rd on the top 100 quotes list with, "You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody. Instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it." That was probably about as bad as it gets, but... He's not my best impression, Marlon Brando. That's why I didn't even bother trying to do him. As far as the influence, I guess we talked about it already. The cab scene in particular, it seems to have inspired almost everybody who's ever gone into acting or directing or movies in general. People revere this movie. I mentioned Raging Bull as a film and the subtext of it. Jake LaMotta's legitimate storyline is kind of a follow-up of Terry Molloy's fictional one.
Mm-hmm.
The other one I would have to say, as far as influence goes, is just a vast scope of people. The group of De Niro, Nicholson, Pacino, Hoffman, that whole group of people, and then certainly actors that came after, that revere Brando in particular, in the style of acting, the method acting, but Brando in particular, and probably would point this film as the one that set them on their path of, I'm going to do that. I'm going to be like that guy. I'm going to live in the moment, be that like that guy, and have the glove scene, have the cab scene, have all the other stuff. And that's pretty big because we're going to start talking about those actors in the late 60s. And then those four people I mentioned, De Niro, Pacino, Nicholson, and Hoffman, are in a lot of AFI movies.
And now it's the dominant style of acting. The more natural, the better.
It tends to get rewarded a lot at the Oscars and the other award shows, too. So final thoughts on The Waterfront. You didn't like it that much?
I just didn't. And I don't think it was like I saw it on the wrong day or something. I just genuinely, I don't know, it just didn't move me. It didn't do it for me.
Maybe you're just sick of the 4x3 black and white movies. You need a widescreen color movie.
I think I might be a little sick of the sausage fest. Like, I've seen a lot of movies in a row that have been really macho. We've seen some
women. We talked about that.
Yeah, but I'm saying that having a handful of women in the cast is one thing, but they're just like macho films that kind of play to macho themes.
Sunset Boulevard, all about this one is
particularly overwhelming. No, I guess that wasn't that long ago, but...
And we did Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind with Kate Winslet not that long ago. It's a Now 100 Project movie.
No, that's true. But still, like, you have a lot of... I don't know, this movie, there was only one woman that had a speaking part, and she was like a saint. She did her best, but it's kind of a character that had not that much complexity. And it's about dock workers, boxers, and thugs. Maybe part of it is just this is like a dude movie, and that's why I couldn't get into it.
We get a lot of those on the project.
I know. Too. Oh, I know. Wait till you see my reaction to Raging Bull. Another movie I just don't get.
We'll be referring to this one again when we get to Raging Bull, ironically. All right, well, I'm a big fan. I think the movie's got all the things it's supposed to have. Pretty good story, the great performances, very authentic. You feel like you're there. You feel like you're cold. We're still in the middle of such a cold streak here in Canada and certainly in the States and everywhere else. Hoboken, New Jersey as well, I'm sure is still ice cold. So we can really relate to that at this moment in time, I would say, too. And the characters in the end. I mean, I feel inspired by a guy who takes an absolute pounding like that and gets up. And Carl Malden's probably two best moments of the whole movie are when he's lecturing everybody after Dugan gets killed by the whiskey and he's down in the hold of the ship. And at the very end, when he's telling Terry, if you go in there and the men will follow you, but you got to walk in on your own. And I think that's pretty inspiring stuff. It wasn't as emotional to me as what was in Shane. We talked about that a few weeks ago, how I was so touched by that. But it was still pretty effective and pretty emotional, I thought. And then the bad guy gets his in a way because they all ignore him, and that's something that he can't handle because his career is probably over anyway.
His power was kind of imaginary. It was only he only had power because people listened to him.
Mm-hmm. The terrorist is no more. We hope anyway. All right. So next week we are going to take another break from the Top 100 Project to bring you our fifth installment of the Not 100 Project. This will be a multi-movie peek at films from Canada, our home and native land. We're going to discuss three in particular, The Barbarian Invasions, Cube, and The Sweet Hereafter. And then we're going to spend some time discussing Canadian flicks and filmmakers in general, the David Cronenbergs, the Sarah Paulies, I can't remember all their names now, but a lot of the...
I'm sure there's more than two.
But we're not just going to talk about people who are Canadian who make movies. We would be doing this for 3 hours. We're going to talk about people who are Canadian filmmakers who are making Canadian movies or who have made Canadian movies. That's the whole point of this. Because if we did the other thing, it'd be Jim Carrey and his whole oeuvre all of James Cameron's movies and everything else. But we're also, as a bonus, going to do something we've never done before. It'll be a Top 100 Project exclusive. We're going to interview the writer of Cube, Bev's friend, Andre Bajelic. We're going to sit down with him for a little while and see what he thinks about the movie. He wrote it a long time ago with the director.
Yeah.
And we're going to see what he thinks about it now. And all that is next week. So, the coming attractions trivia question. There were 2 years in which a Canadian director was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Director. Ironically, in both cases, there were two Canadian nominees those years. Who were those directors? You gotta save it for next week.
I know what one of them is.
All right. So you'll be tuning in next week for that. So as we said, we'll talk about three movies. We'll talk about films in general. We'll get an interview. It might be a little longer than normal, but we'll try not to go on as long. Hey, we don't have anything to compare it to. There's no AFI list to mention because none of these films could have made an AFI list. So another change of pace there. And then after that, we get to Rear Window when we get into April and we get Rebel Without a Cause and Giant, The Searchers. That's all coming up in April.
In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and you can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. We'd love to hear what you think about On the Waterfront. Read me the riot act on my opinion. I'd love to hear...
Read it to her.
Tell me what I'm missing. Please send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
And then you'd be a contender.
And cut.